Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. As President Biden alluded to last night, we are struggling to comprehend the incomprehensible. That 500,000 of our fellow Americans and another 2 million more people around the globe have lost their lives to the COVID-19 virus over the short span of a year. We have also lost, in many cases, the traditional ways of grieving those tragic deaths. My next guest is Dr. Dorothy Hollinger. She's a staff psychologist in Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center's Department of Neurology and the Mass General Brigham Hospital's Department of Psychiatry up in Boston, and the author of a book called The Anatomy of Grief. Dr. Hollinger, welcome to the show. Thanks for your time.
Oh, hello, Tom. I'm glad to be here with you.
So in an early chapter in your book, you talk about all the many different forms of grief, from the most common to the less common. But there are, I didn't count them, but there are 20 or 30 of them, it seems.
There are a lot, yes.
Yeah. And I want to talk about one of the last ones that you mentioned in relation to the president last night. And you, this is what you call ceremonial grief. Why do you think, or do you think, it's important for the president to have done the kind of ceremony that he did last night, as well as the one he did the night before he was inaugurated? What is the benefit to the country in that kind of endeavor?
Oh, it's really important. And I called it ceremonial, but I think I also included the word collective, which I think that we're all experiencing. And it's been postponed, our experience of this as a nation. And what President Biden has done, and Vice President Harris, last January 19th and yesterday, February 22nd, they've helped us begin to do this, to begin to grieve as a nation. And that is just so important, because we need to remember what has happened, what we've lost, and the people we've lost, the victims of COVID. And, you know, to humanize what I said, victims, I mean, those are our mothers, our fathers, our children, in some cases, our sisters, brothers, significant others, spouses. I mean, we've lost a huge number. I mean, we just have never, ever imagined last year that we would be in this place. And for Biden and Harris to do this, I mean, it was just absolutely marvelous. They've pulled us into beginning to heal, because we're collectively grieving.
You talk about the changes that happen to the human self of those who are in bereavement. The brain is grief-stricken. The heart is breaking. The body is hurting. What is the data? What is your experience as a clinician? Tell us about how the human self changes when we are grieving.
Oh, my. It just has such a profound effect. The brain has to get used to the loved one not being there any longer. And that's, I say get used to, and it's kind of a conditioning to go to all the places that you've been with the loved one, say your father, and he's not there anymore, and you have to go through all the holidays without him. That pulls you into a place where the brain has to get used to no longer firing those neurons with that particular person, with your loved one. And as far as the heart is concerned, because, you know, a death will affect the brain, it will become grief-stricken. It will affect the heart. It will break, both metaphorically and sometimes biologically. You know, there's something called the broken heart syndrome. Takotsubo cardiomyopathy is the official name. And it's very rare, but it can happen if somebody comes into an emergency room and with symptoms of a heart attack, shortness of breath, and chest pain. But that it's not a heart attack, it's a broken heart. And by the way, what happens with that is the left ventricle expands in a way that makes the bottom of the heart look rounded, and the top with the aorta is that narrow part. It looks like a Japanese octopus catching part, that pot. That's where the name Takotsubo comes from. But that, by the way, can heal very rapidly and with no lasting damage. And the body, oh my goodness, sleep is affected, appetite. You know, there's something called widow's weight. Some women lose a great deal of weight. Food doesn't taste the same. In fact, I had a friend who told me that she, after her mother died, she just kept eating, and she was puzzled by, it didn't taste good. And she realized after a while that it was connected to the death of her mother, her beloved mother. And it went away eventually, but it was, she said it was really such a puzzle until she put it together. And in terms of patients I've had, oh my goodness, there are so many, which one to choose. They've really worked with grief that has been, well, I think I'll take the example of somebody whose mother had died, and she found out about it when she was about 10. Her sister called her. My patient was at a friend's house, and her sister called and said, you know, where have you been? Mommy's dead. Well, and then after that, with all of the rituals, with the funeral, et cetera, she wanted to talk about it with her father, and he said, I'm sorry, I can't talk about it. And she couldn't, and the family couldn't. They simply could not talk about the death of her mother, and that's what's called forbidden grief. And that can happen more often than we realize. It happens actually to children probably more often, because they're the ones that are told, and they get frightened by not being able to talk about what happened. They don't understand it really. So in therapy, when she came in, and she came in because her husband had died, and it was a difficult, difficult grief for her. She actually experienced that widow's weight. She lost a great deal of weight. As she said later, I was very glad because I was really a little bit overweight. But this was much, much later when the grief that she experienced, she had really worked with and worked through. But one day, but there were times that she became very angry without really, it didn't make sense either to her or to me. And finally, what began to emerge was this memory of her mother that had been really, really pushed down, ignored, and actually not remembered. And she began to access that, and it was really amazing. It was quite an epiphany for her. And yeah, she cried and cried and finally realized that she was in a safe place where she could talk about this. And she did, and she was able to address the anger at her sister for calling her like that and saying that, and also the anger at her mother and the anger at her father. All three of those people, she was able to come to terms with those feelings, and
yeah,
she
and
was
all
able
these
to
things are, yeah, they're inextricably linked, aren't they? You know,
absolutely,
love, anger, you know, it's a complicated web. Dr. Dorothy Hollinger, she's the author of The Anatomy of Grief. It's midday. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us as well. And Dr. Hollinger, one of the goals you write about in the book is to help folks learn how to let the sadness run its course.
Oh, yeah.
Is it true then that, you know, time heals all wounds, as the old saying goes? I mean, the nature of grief does change over time, but is time sort of the central only element? What else needs to be larded on to the passage of time to make that transition from grief to warm memories a reality.
Oh, that's beautifully put, Tom. It is time, but it's also several other things. One is, as I think you mentioned, to allow grief to run its course, not to be afraid of it, not to be afraid of those overwhelming feelings of sadness, of feeling abandoned, empty. But another, I think, that I stress in the book is that is critical is to put grief into words. Research has shown that putting negative feelings into words can change brain processing. It goes from the feeling brain, the amygdala, back up to the thinking brain, which is the prefrontal cortex. And this doesn't stop grief. It just helps ease it. And to be able to do that, I stress, actually, probably as much as possible, talk about it. And, you know, people don't want to talk about grief. They don't want to talk about negative things. And with this emotion, it's really important to talk about it. And it eventually does begin to change. It begins to quiet, although there are times when it absolutely bubbles up and erupts for some people. For example, with an anniversary, something that just can remind the bereaved of that beloved person, a song, an aroma, you know, an apple pie that someone's mother made that they loved so much. So, and to remember that in addition to not being afraid of what you're feeling, that grief is the price we pay for love. You know, as much as we love that person, I think that there's that much grief that we have to go through. And as it begins to quiet, as it begins to calm, it changes. And as I say in the last chapter, I talk about how grief, like, that can be experienced and viewed as leaden, can change to gold, can change to joy. When all of us get together and remember that lost loved one, that sister who died, and talk about her and cry and hold hands, which, by the way, we have not been able to do in this terrible, terrible pandemic when funerals have become virtual. We see images and we're not with people. When we're together and those memories begin to emerge, and with people to talk about how fun the sister was, what silly things she did, and to chuckle, to smile, as well as to cry. I mean, it's bittersweet, yeah. But it can change.
You write that for each of us, our grief is our own. It's an individual experience. Often, when we are newly in bereavement, it's difficult to come up with the words, and it's difficult to come up with the language around grief. You write that we're thrown back into a world without words, like a preverbal child. It's disorienting. That's the other thing about grief. It really is. You get out of your rhythm, and it's tough to get back in.
Oh, it is. Well, you know, the words change. I talk about that in the third chapter, the language of grief. One has always been used to somebody else saying, oh, my mother died, or my father, or someone died. But to be able to take those words and use that tense, my sister died, and of all the awful griefs that we can experience, a child died, to put that in the past and to be able to do that, it takes a while. Like everything else with grief, after we've lost someone, after someone that we've loved so very much has died, it's a getting used to. As I mentioned before, with the brain and neurons firing, it's getting used to not being with them because they're not there. And, you know, one other thing that I think is helpful to think about, the person that we were with that loved one is no longer, we're no longer that person. We can't be, because the person that we were with, the relationship we had is gone. So, you know, it's just so very complicated and actually amazing, because another, a positive outcome of grief is that, you know, crisis often can create new beginings, can create something creative, sure. Like art.
And Doctor, on that somewhat hopeful note, we're going to have to call it a day. We're out of time. Dorothy Hollinger, her book is called The Anatomy of Grief. Thank you, Dr. Hollinger. I appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you, Tom. It was wonderful to talk with you.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Harriet Washington joins me to discuss her latest book, Carte Blanche, The Erosion of Medical Consent. That's coming up tomorrow. Coming up now, it's Here and Now. And this programming note about a podcast that I'm involved with, the Chesapeake Connect podcast, features interviews with local leaders about issues that affect the Baltimore metro region. So I invite you to check out my conversations with Baltimore County Executive Johnny Olszewski Jr., State Senate President Bill Ferguson, Scott Spencer of the N.E. Casey Foundation, Shanaysha Sauls of the Baltimore Community Foundation. You can find it on the WYPR website. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. We'll talk again tomorrow.
You're listening to your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.